Books on Tape presents Skeleton Coast by Clive Cussler with Jack DeBruhl. Read by Scott Brick.
Chapter 1. Kalahari Desert, 1896. He never should have ordered them to leave the guns behind. The decision would cost them all their lives. But had there really been a choice? When the last remaining pack horse went lame, they'd had to redistribute its load, and that meant leaving equipment behind. There was no debating the necessity of bringing the water flasks the animal had carried, or the satchels bursting with uncut stones. They'd had to abandon the tents, bedrolls, 30 pounds of food, and the Martini Henry rifles each of the 5 men had carried, as well as all the ammunition. But even with these weight savings, the surviving horses were severely overburdened, and with the sun beginning to rise once more to pound the desert, no one expected their mounts would last the day. H.A. Ryder knew better than to agree to lead the others across the Kalahari. He was an old Africa hand, having abandoned a failing farm in Sussex in the heady days of the Kimberley Rush, hoping to make himself a millionaire in the diamond fields. By the time he'd arrived in 1868, the whole of Colesberg Kopje, the hillock where the first diamonds had been discovered, was staked, and the fields around it too, for several miles. So Ryder turned to providing meat for the army of workers. With a pair of wagons and hundreds of sacks of salt to cure the game, he and a couple of native guides ranged over thousands of square miles. It had been a solitary existence, but one that Ryder grew to love, just as he came to love the land, with its haunting sunsets and dense forests, streams so clear the water looked like glass, and horizons so distant they seemed impossible to reach. He learned to speak the languages of various tribes, the Matabele, the Mashona, and the fierce, warlike Herero. He even understood some of the strange clicks and whistles that the bushmen of the desert used to communicate. He'd taken work as a safari guide so that rich Englishmen and Americans could adorn their mansion walls with trophies, and he had spent time finding suitable routes for a telegraph company stringing lines across the southern third of the continent. He'd fought in a dozen skirmishes and killed 10 times that many men. He knew and understood the African people and knew better still the savagery of the land itself. He knew he should have never accepted the job of guiding the others from Bechuanaland across the vast Kalahari wasteland in a mad dash to the sea. But there was always the lure of the big payoff, the siren song of instant wealth that had drawn him to Africa in the first place. If they somehow made it, if the uncaring desert didn't claim them, then H.A. Ryder was going to have that fortune of which he'd always dreamed.
"Think they're still back there, H.A.?"
Ryder squinted into the rising sun so that his eyes nearly vanished into his weathered skin. He could see nothing on the distant horizon but curtains of shimmering heat that formed and dissolved like smoke. Between them and the fiery sun marched dunes of pure white sand, shifting waves that rivaled towering hurricane swells. With the sun came the wind, which lashed at the tops of the dunes so that sand blew off their crests in stinging clouds.
"Aye, laddie," he said without looking at the man standing next to him.
"How can you be sure?" H.A. turned to his companion, John Varley.
"They'll follow us to the gates of hell for what we did to them."
The certainty in H.A.'s raspy voice made Varley blanch under his tan. Like Ryder, the 4 other men in their party were all English-born and had come to Africa to seek their fortunes, though none was as seasoned as their guide.
"We'd best get going," Ryder said.
They'd been traveling under the relatively cool cover of darkness.
We can cover a few miles before the sun climbs too high.
I think we should make camp here, said Peter Smythe, the greenest member of the group and by far the worst off. He'd lost his swaggering attitude shortly after entering the sand sea and now moved with the shuffling gait of an old man. White crusts had formed at the corners of his eyes and mouth, while his once bright blue eyes had grown dim. Ryder glanced at Peter and saw the signs immediately. They'd all shared the same water ration since filling their canteens and jerry cans 10 days earlier at a brackish well, but Smythe's body seemed to need more than the others. It wasn't a question of strength or will. It was simply the lad needed to drink more to stay alive. H.A. knew to the drop how much water remained, and unless he could find another desert well, Smythe would be the first to die. The thought of giving him an extra ration never entered Ryder's mind.
We go on.
He looked westward and saw the mirror image of the terrain they'd already covered. Sand dune piled upon sand dune in endless ranks that stretched seemingly forever. The sky was turning brassy as light reflected off the infinite desert. Ryder checked his mount. The animal was suffering, and for that he felt guilty. Worse than his feelings for young Smythe, in fact, for the poor animal had no choice but to carry them across this cruel environment. He used a clasp knife to remove a stone from the horse's hoof and adjusted the saddle blanket where the pannier straps were beginning to chafe. The animal's once glossy coat was dull and hung in flaps where its flesh had begun to waste away. He stroked the horse's cheek and muttered a few soothing words into its ear. There was no way any of them could ride their mounts. The animals were already struggling under their lightened loads. He took up the reins and started off. Ryder's boots sank to the uppers as he led the horse down the face of a dune. Sand shifted under them, hissing and sliding down the embankment and threatening to send the pair tumbling if either took a misstep. H.A. didn't look back. The men had no choice but to follow or die where they stood. He walked for an hour as the sun continued its inexorable climb into the cloudless sky. He'd tucked a smooth pebble between his teeth and tongue to try to fool his body that he wasn't severely dehydrated. When he paused to wipe the inside of his big slouch hat, the heat scorched the red patch of skin on the crown of his head. He wanted to go for another hour, but he could hear the men struggling behind him. They weren't yet at the point where he would consider abandoning them, so he led them to the lee of a particularly tall dune and began to erect a sunshade using the horse blankets. The men flopped to the ground, panting as he set up their meager camp. H.A. checked on Peter Smythe. The young man's lips were nothing but raw blisters that leaked clear fluid, and the tops of his cheeks were burned as if with an iron straight from the brazier. Ryder reminded him to only loosen his bootlaces. All of their feet were so swollen that to remove their boots meant they'd never get them back on again. They watched him expectantly as he finally took a couple of canteens from a saddlebag. He unstoppered one of them, and immediately one of the horses nickered at the scent of water. The others crowded over, and his own mount brushed its head against H.A.'s shoulder. So as not to lose even a single drop, Ryder poured a measure into a bowl and held it for the animal to drink. It slurped noisily, and its stomach rumbled as water reached it for the first time in 3 days. He poured out a little more and again watered the horse. He did this to all of them first, despite his own raging thirst and the angry glares of his companions.
They die. You die, was all he had to say, for they knew he was right.
Having drunk only a quart of water each, the horses could still be cajoled to eat from the feed bags of oats one of them had carried. He hobbled them with leg ropes, and only then did he pass around the bowl for the men to drink. He was even stricter with their ration, each receiving a single mouthful before Ryder secured the water in his pannier. There were no protests. H.A. was the only one of them to have crossed this desolate wasteland before, and they deferred to him to see them through. The shade of the horse blankets was pitiably small compared to the searing oven that was the Kalahari, one of the hottest and driest places on earth, a land where the rain might fall once a year or not for many. As the sun beat the earth with hammer strokes of heat, the men lay in torpid lethargy, shifting only when the shadows moved with the revolving sun to expose a hand or leg to the brutal onslaught. They lay with their all-consuming thirst, and they lay with their pain, but mostly they lay with their greed, for these were still motivated men. Men close to becoming far wealthier than any had imagined. When the sun reached its zenith, it seemed to gain strength, making the act of breathing a battle between the need for air and the desire to keep the heat from entering their bodies. It sucked moisture from the men with each shallow breath and left their lungs aflame. And still the heat had increased, a smothering weight that seemed to crush the men into the ground. Ryder didn't remember it being this bad when he had crossed the desert all those years ago. It was as if the sun had fallen from the heavens and now lay upon the earth, raging and angry that mere mortals were trying to defy it. It was enough to drive a man insane, and yet they endured the long afternoon, praying for the day to finally end. As swiftly as the heat had built up, it began to drop as the sun finally settled toward the western horizon, painting the sand with bands of red and purple and rose. The men slowly emerged from under the sunshade, brushing dust off their filthy clothes. Ryder scaled the dune that had protected them from the wind and panned the desert behind them with a collapsible brass telescope for sign of their pursuers. He could see nothing but shifting dunes. Their tracks had been scoured clean by the constant zephyrs, though it gave him little comfort. The men chasing them were some of the best trackers in the world. They would find them in the featureless sand sea as surely as if Ryder had left a trail of marker stones for them to follow. What he didn't know was how much ground their stalkers had gained during the day, for they seemed superhuman in their abilities to withstand the sun and heat. H.A. had estimated that when they entered the desert, they had a 5-day lead on their pursuers. He felt confident that they held no more than a day's advantage now. By tomorrow, that would be whittled further to half a day. And then? The next day would be when they would pay for abandoning their weapons when the pack horse went lame. Their only chance was to find enough water tonight for the horses so they could ride them once again. Not enough of the precious fluid remained to water the horses, and the men's ration was half of what they'd had just after dawn. For Ryder, it was like adding insult to injury. The warm trickle seemed to just seep into his tongue rather than slake his thirst, which was now a gnawing ache in his stomach. He forced himself to eat some dried beef. Looking at the raw-boned faces around him, H.A. knew that tonight's march was going to be torture. Peter Smythe couldn't stop himself from swaying where he stood. John Varley wasn't much better off. Only the brothers, Tim and Tom Waterman, seemed okay, but they had been in Africa longer than Smythe or Varley, working as farmhands on a big Cape cattle ranch for the past decade. Their bodies were more acclimated to Africa's brutal sun. H.A. ran his hands through his big mutton chop sideburns, combing sand from the coarse, graying hair. When he bent to tighten his bootlaces, he felt twice his 50 years. His back and legs ached fiercely, and the vertebra popped when he stood again.
"This is it, lads. You have my word that tonight we will drink our fill,"
he said to bolster their flagging morale.
"On what?
Sand?" Tim Waterman joked to show he still could.
"The bushmen who call themselves the Sun have lived in this desert for 1,000 years or more. It's said they can smell water 100 miles off, and that's not far off the mark. When I came through the Kalahari 20 years ago, I had a Sun guide. The little bugger found water where I would have never thought to look. They scooped it from plants when there was a fog in the morning and drank from the rumen of the animals they killed with their poison arrows."
"What's a rumen?" Varley asked. Ryder exchanged a glance with the Waterman brothers as if to say everyone should know the term.
"It's the first stomach in an animal, like a cow or antelope, where they produce their cud. The fluid in it is mostly water and plant juice."
"I could go for some of that now,"
Peter Smythe managed to mumble. A single drop of claret-red blood clung to the corner of his cracked lip. He licked it away before it could fall to the earth.
"But the Sun's greatest ability is to find water buried under the sand in dried-out riverbeds that haven't flowed in a generation."
"Can you find water like them?"
John Varley asked.
"I've been looking in every stream bed we've crossed for the past 5 days," H.A. said.
The men were startled. None of them had realized they'd crossed any dried-out rivers. To them, the desert had been featureless and empty. That H.A. had known about the wadis increased their confidence that he would see them out of this nightmare. Ryder continued,
"There was a promising one day before yesterday, but I couldn't be certain, and we can't afford the time for me to be wrong. I estimate we're 2, maybe 3 days from the coast, which means this part of the desert gets moisture off the ocean, plus the occasional storm. I'll find us water, lads. Of that you can be sure."
It was the most H.A. had spoken since telling the men to dump their guns, and it had the desired effect. The Waterman brothers grinned. John Varley managed to square his shoulders, and even young Smythe stopped swaying. A cold moon began to climb behind them as the last rays of the sun sank into the distant Atlantic, and soon the sky was carpeted with more stars than a man could count in 100 lifetimes. The desert was as silent as a church, save for the hiss of sand shifting under boots and hooves and the occasional creak of leather saddlery. Their pace was steady and measured. H.A. was well aware of their weakened condition, but never forgot the hordes that were surely on their trail. He called the first halt at midnight. The nature of the desert had changed slightly. While they still slogged through ankle-deep sand, there were patches of loose gravel in many of the valleys. H.A. had spotted old watering holes in a few of the washes, places where eland and antelope had dug into the hard pan searching for underground water. He saw no sign of humans ever using them, so he assumed they had dried out eons ago. He didn't mention his discovery to the men, but it served to bolster his confidence in finding them a working well. He allowed the men a double share of water, sure now that he could replenish the canteens and water the horses before sunup. And if he didn't, there was no use in rationing, for the desert would claim them on the morrow. Ryder gave half his ration to his horse, although the others eagerly drank theirs down with little regard to the pack animals. A rare cloud blotted the moon a half hour after they started marching again, and when it passed, the shifting illumination caused something on the desert floor to catch Ryder's eye. According to his compass and the stars, he'd been following a due westerly direction, and none of the men commented when he suddenly turned north. He paced ahead of the others, aware of the flaky soil crunching under his boots, and when he reached the spot, he dropped to his knees. It was merely a dimple in the otherwise flat valley, no more than 3 feet across. He cast his gaze around the spot, smiling tightly when he found bits of broken eggshell, and one that was almost intact except for a long crack that ran like a fault line along its smooth surface. The shell was the size of his fist and had a neat hole drilled through the top. Its stopper was a tuft of dried grass mixed with native gum. It was one of the Sans' most prized possessions, for without these ostrich eggs they had no way to transport water. That one broke when they were refilling could have very well doomed the party of bushmen who last used the well. H.A. almost felt their ghosts staring down on him from the ancient riverbed's bank, tiny little spirits wearing nothing but a crown of reeds around their heads and a rawhide belt festooned with pouches for their ostrich eggs and a quiver for the small poisoned arrows they used to take game.
"What have you found, H.A.?" John Varley asked, kneeling in the dirt next to the guide.
His once shining dark hair fell lank around his shoulders, but he had somehow maintained the piratical gleam in his eyes. They were the eyes of a desperate schemer, a man driven by dreams of instant wealth and one willing to risk death to see them fulfilled.
"Water, Mr. Varley."
Though 20 years his senior, H.A. tried to speak deferentially to all his clients.
"What? How? I don't see anything."
The Waterman brothers sat on a nearby boulder. Peter Smythe collapsed at their feet. Tim helped the lad move upright so his back was against the water-worn rock. His head lolled against his thin chest, and his breathing was unnaturally shallow.
"It's underground, like I told you."
"How do we get it out?"
"We dig."
Without another word, the two men began scraping back the soil that a bushman had laboriously used to refill the precious well so that it didn't dry out. H.A.'s hands were broad and so calloused that he could use them like shovels, tearing into the friable earth with little regard to the flinty shards. Varley had the hands of a gambler, smooth and, at one point, neatly manicured, but he dug just as hard as the guide, raging thirst allowing him to ignore the cuts and scrapes and the blood that dripped from his fingertips. They excavated 2 feet of earth and still no sign of water. They had to expand the hole because they were much bigger than the bushman warriors whose job it was to dig these wells. At 3 feet, H.A. took out a scoopful of dirt, and when he dropped it away from the hole, a thin layer clung to his skin. He rolled it between his fingers until he'd produced a little ball of mud. When he squeezed it, a quivering drop of water shone in the starlight. Varley whooped, and even H.A. cracked an uncommon smile. They redoubled their efforts, slinging mud from the hole with reckless abandon. Ryder had to put a restraining hand on Varley's shoulder when he felt they'd dug deep enough. "Now, we wait." The other men crowded around the well, and they watched in expectant silence as the darkened bottom of the excavation suddenly turned white. It was the moon reflecting off water, seeping into the hole from the surrounding aquifer. H.A. used a piece torn from his shirt as a filter and dipped his canteen into the muddy water. It took several minutes for it to fill halfway. Peter moaned when he heard it sloshing as H.A. lifted it from the hole.
"Here you go, lad," Ryder said, handing over the canteen.
Peter reached for it eagerly, but Ryder didn't let go.
"Slowly, my boy. Drink it slowly."
Smythe was too far gone to listen to H.A.'s advice. His first massive gulp sent him into a paroxysm of coughing, and the mouthful of water was wasted on the desert floor. When he'd recovered, he took tentative sips, looking sheepish. It took 4 hours to recover enough water for the men to drink their fill and finally managed to eat their first meal in days. H.A. was still watering the horses when the sun began to brush against the eastern horizon. He was careful with them so they wouldn't bloat or cramp, and fed them sparingly, but still their great bellies rumbled with contentment as they ate and managed to stale for the first time in days.
H.A.!
Tim Waterman had gone over the riverbank to relieve himself in private. He stood silhouetted against the dawn, frantically waving his hat and pointing toward the rising sun. Ryder plucked his telescope from his saddlebag and raced from the horses, climbing the hill like a man possessed. He smashed into Waterman so both fell to the dust. Before Tim could protest, Ryder clamped a hand over his companion's mouth and hissed,
"Keep your voice down. Sound travels well over the desert."
Lying flat, H.A. extended the telescope and set it against his eye.
"Look at them come," he thought. "God, they are magnificent."
What had brought these five men together was Peter Smythe's utter hatred of his father, a fearsome man who claimed to have had a vision of the Archangel Gabriel. The angel had told Lucas Smythe to sell everything he owned and travel to Africa to spread the word of God among the savages. While not particularly religious before his vision, Smythe devoted himself to the Bible with such urgency that when he applied to the London Missionary Society, they considered denying his application because he had become a zealot. But in the end, the society accepted him, if for no other reason than to get him away from their offices. They sent him and his begrudging wife and son to Bechuanaland, where he was to replace a minister who died of malaria. Away from the constraints of society, at a tiny mission in the heart of the Herero people, Smythe became a religious tyrant. For his was a vengeful God who demanded total self-sacrifice and severe penitence for even the most minor transgressions. It was nothing for Peter to be cane-whipped by his father because he mumbled the last words of a prayer or be denied dinner for not being able to recite a particular psalm on command. At the time of the family's arrival, the Herero king, Samuel Maharero, who had been baptized some decades earlier, was in a bitter dispute with the colonial authorities, and thus shunned the German minister sent to his lands by the Rhenish Mission Society. Lucas Smythe and his family enjoyed the patronage of the king, even if Maharero was hesitant of Smythe's rantings of hellfire and brimstone. While young Peter enjoyed his friendships with the king's many grandchildren, life as a teen near the royal kraal was tedium, punctuated with moments of terror when the spirit seized his father, and he wanted nothing more than to run away. And so he plotted his escape, confiding in Asa Maharero, one of the king's grandsons and his best friend, what he intended to do. It was during one of their many strategy sessions that Peter Smythe made the discovery that would change his life. He was in a storage rendezvous, a circular hut the Herero used to store fodder when the fields were too barren for their thousands of cattle. It was the place he and Asa had chosen as their hideout, and though Peter had been there dozens of times, this was the first he noticed that the hard-packed earth along one mud and grass wall had been dug up. The black soil had been carefully tamped down, but his sharp eye spotted the irregularity. He used his hands to dig into the spot and discovered that there was only a thin layer of soil laid over a dozen large earthen beer pots. The jugs were the size of his head, and a membrane of cowhide had been stretched over their tops. He lifted one of them from its resting place. It was heavy, and he could feel something rattling around inside. Peter carefully worked the stitches around the rim, loosening them just enough so that when he tipped the pot, a few unremarkable stones dropped into his palm. He began to shake. While they looked nothing like the stylized drawings of faceted stones he'd seen, he knew by how they scattered the meager light in the hut that he was holding 6 uncut diamonds. The smallest was the size of his thumbnail, the largest more than twice as big. Just then Asa ducked through the arched doorway and saw what his friend had uncovered. His eyes went wide with terror, and he quickly looked over his shoulder to see if any adults were about. Across the fenced stockade, a couple of boys were watching some cattle, and a woman was walking a few hundred yards away with a bundle of grass perched atop her head. He leapt across the rendezvous and took the beer pot from Peter's startled fingers.
"What have you done?"
Asa hissed in his odd German-accented English.
"Nothing, Asa. I swear," Peter cried guiltily. "I saw that something had been buried, and I just wanted to see what it was, is all."
Asa held out a hand, and Peter dumped the loose stones into his palm. The young African prince spoke as he tucked the stones back under the leather cover.
"On pain of death, you must never speak of this to anyone. Those are diamonds, aren't they?"
Asa regarded his friend.
"Yes." "But how? There are no diamonds here. They're all down in the Cape Colony around Kimberley."
Asa sat cross-legged in front of Peter, torn between his oath to his grandfather and pride at what his tribe had accomplished. He was 3 years younger than Peter, just 13, so youthful boasting won out over his solemn promise.
"I will tell you, but you must never repeat it."
"I swear, Asa."
"Since diamonds were first discovered, men of the Herero tribe have traveled to Kimberley to work in the pits. They worked a 1-year contract and came home with the pay the white miners gave them, but they also took something else. They stole stones."
"I heard that the men are searched before they are allowed to leave the miners' camps, even their bums.
What our men did was cut their skin and place the stones inside the wound. When it scarred over, there was no evidence. Upon their return, they reopened the wounds with assegais and retrieved the stones to present to my great-grandfather, Chief Kamaherero, who had first ordered them south to Kimberley.
Asa, some of these stones are pretty big. Surely they would have been discovered,"
Peter protested. Asa laughed.
"And some Herero warriors are pretty big, too."
He then turned serious as he continued the tale.
"This went on for many years, as many as 20. But then the white miners discovered what the Herero were doing. 100 were arrested, and even those who hadn't yet hid a stone under their skin were found guilty of stealing. They were all put to death. When the time is right, we will use these stones to throw off the yoke of the German colonial office."
His dark eyes shone.
"And we will again live as free men. Now, swear to me again, Peter, that you will tell no one that you have discovered the treasure."
Peter's gaze met that of his young friend, and he said,
"I swear."
His oath lasted him less than a year. When he turned 18, he left the little mission in the center of the royal compound. He told no one that he was leaving, not even his mother, and for that he felt guilty. She alone would have to bear the weight of Lucas Smythe's righteous tirades. Peter had always felt he was a survivor. He and Asa had camped dozens of times on the veldt, but by the time he reached a trading station 50 miles from the mission, he was nearly dead from exhaustion and thirst. There he spent a couple of the precious coins he'd hoarded from birthday presents from his mother. His father never gave him anything, believing that the only birth the family should celebrate was that of Jesus Christ. There was barely enough to pay the wagon master to take him to Kimberley on the buckboard of a 20-oxen span returning south with a load of ivory and salted meat. The wagon master was an older man wearing a huge white hat and had the thickest sideburns Peter had ever seen. Tagging along with H.A. Ryder were a pair of brothers who'd been promised grazing land by the Cape Colonial Office, only to find it already occupied by Matabele. With no desire to fight an army, they had prudently chosen to return south. Also with the party was a lean, hawk-faced man named John Varley. In the weeks they trudged south, Peter never did get a sense of what Varley did or what had brought him so far from the Cape Colony. All he knew was that he didn't trust the man as far as he could spit. At camp one night following the dangerous crossing of a river where Peter saved the life of one of Ryder's oxen by actually jumping on the animal's back and riding it across like a horse, Varley revealed a cache of liquor. It was fiery Cape brandy, as raw as pure spirits, but the five of them sat around a campfire digesting a meal of guinea fowl that Tim Waterman had taken with his shotgun and drank the two bottles empty. It was Peter's first taste of alcohol and, unlike the others, the brandy went to his head after only the first tentative sips. It was inevitable that talk would turn to prospecting, since it was second nature for anyone in the bush to keep a sharp eye for minerals. It seemed every day a new diamond field or gold reef or coal mine was staked, and someone became an instant millionaire. Peter knew he shouldn't have opened his mouth. He'd made a pledge to Asa. But he wanted to fit in with these rough-and-ready men who spoke so knowledgeably about things he himself was unaware. They were worldly, especially Varley and H.A., and Peter wanted them to respect him more than anything he'd ever wanted in his life. So with lips made slack by brandy, he told them of the dozen clay pots filled with uncut diamonds in the royal kraal of King Maharero. "How do you know this boy?" Varley had hissed like an adder. "Because the lad's father is the preacher in Hereraland," H.A. had answered and looked at Peter. "Oh, I recognize you now. Oh, I met your old man a couple of seasons back when I went to see the king about hunting concessions on his land." His steady eyes swept the group. "He's been living with the Herero. What, 5 years now?" "Almost 6," Peter answered proudly. "They know me and trust me." Before another 15 minutes had passed, they were discussing openly the possibility of stealing the beer pots. Peter went along with the scheme only after the others promised that the five of them would only take one container each and leave 7 for the Herero people. Otherwise, he wouldn't tell them where the stones were located. At a trading post a further 100 miles south, H.A. Ryder sold his wagon and its precious load for half of what he could have fetched for the ivory in Kimberley and outfitted the men with proper horses and gear. He'd already decided the course they would take out of the Herero Empire, the one that afforded their only chance of escape once the theft was discovered. The trading post was at the end of a newly laid telegraph line. The men waited 3 days while Ryder made arrangements with a trader he knew in Cape Town. H.A. shrugged off the staggering cost of what he ordered, figuring he'd either be a millionaire able to pay the debt or a corpse lying in the searing Kalahari sun. It was impossible to sneak into the royal kraal. Runners reported their presence to the king as soon as they crossed into his domain. But H.A. was known to the king, and Peter's father was surely eager to have his son returned to him, though Peter suspected he'd be given a treatment worthy of Job rather than that of the prodigal son. It took a week to reach the kraal from the border, and Samuel Maharero himself greeted the riders when they finally reached his camp. He and H.A. spoke for an hour in the king's native tongue, the guide giving him news of the outside world since the king was in exile by order of the German colonial office. The king in turn told Peter, to his great relief, that his parents had just left for the bush, where his father was baptizing a group of women and children, and wouldn't return till the following day. The king granted them permission to spend the night, but denied H.A.'s request to hunt on Herero land, as he had 4 years previously.
"Can't blame a man for trying, Your Highness. Persistence is a white man's vice."
That night they'd stolen into the rendezvous. The hut was packed to the roof poles with hay, and they had to burrow into the pile like mice to reach the spot where the diamonds were hidden. It was when John Varley plucked a second pot from the ground and dumped its contents into a saddlebag that Peter Smythe realized he'd been duped from the beginning. The Waterman brothers, too, emptied several pots into their bags. Only H.A. kept his word and took the contents of only one of the beer pots.
"If you don't take them, I will,"
Varley whispered in the dark.
"Your choice," Ryder drawled, "but I'm a man of my word."
As it was, they didn't have enough bags for all the stones, and after stuffing pants pockets and anything else they could, four of the big pots remained unmolested. H.A. carefully reburied the cash and did everything he could to hide the theft. They left camp at dawn, thanking the king for his hospitality. Maharero asked Peter if he had any message for his mother. Peter could only mumble to tell her he was sorry. Lying on the crest of the dune above the waterhole, H.A. allowed himself just a moment to watch the king's men. When they'd started out after the thieves, there had been an entire impi, an army of 1,000 warriors tracking them from the tribal lands. But that had been 500 miles ago, and the hardship had whittled their numbers. H.A. estimated there were still more than 100 of them, the very strongest, and they ran at a ground-eating pace despite their own hunger and thirst. The sun was just high enough to glint off the honed blades of their assegais, the stabbing spears their people used to vanquish any who stood in their way. H.A. tapped Tim Waterman on the leg, and together they slid to the bottom of the dry wash where the others clustered nervously. The horses had picked up on the sudden shift in mood. They shuffled their hoofs in the dust, and their ears twitched as if they could hear the approaching danger.
"Mount up, lads," Ryder said, accepting the reins from Peter Smythe.
"We're going to ride," he asked. "Through the day?"
"Aye, boy. It's that, or one of Maharera's warriors is going to garland his hut with your insides. Let's go. We have only a mile on them, and I don't know how long the horses are going to take the heat."
Ryder was aware that had they not found water last night, the Herero would have been on them like a pack of wild dogs by now. As it was, only one of his canteens was full when he threw a rangy leg over his horse's broad back. They climbed out of the wadi abreast, and all five men turned when they left the shadow of the depression and felt the raw sun burning at the backs of their necks. For the first miles, H.A. kept them at a steady trot that gained them a mile for every three on the advancing Herrero Impi. The sun baked the earth and dried their sweat the instant it burst from their pores. Under the protection of his big slouch hat, H.A. had to ride with his eyes closed to slits to protect them from the blinding reflection off the dunes. Resting under a sunshade as the Kalahari turned into an oven was bad enough, but trying to cross the empty waste under its brutal onslaught was the hardest thing H.A. had ever done in his life. The heat and the light were maddening, as if the fluid in his skull was being boiled. The occasional sip of water did little more than scald his throat and remind him of his raging thirst. Time lost meaning, and it took all of Ryder's concentration to remember to check his compass to steer them ever westward. With so few distinctive landmarks to guide him, his navigation was more guesswork than science, but they pressed on because there was no alternative. The wind, like the sun, was their constant companion. H.A. estimated they weren't more than 20 miles from the South Atlantic and had expected a breeze off the ocean to hit them head on, but the wind kept at them from the rear, always pressing them onward. Ryder prayed that his compass hadn't malfunctioned and the needle that was to guide them to the west was somehow leading them deeper into the raging interior of the molten desert. He checked it constantly, relieved that the men had strung out somewhat so no one could see the consternation on his face. The wind grew, and when he looked back to check on his men, he could see the tops of the dunes were being eaten away. Long plumes of sand were cast from crest to crest. Grit stung his skin and made his eyes tear. He didn't like this at all. They were heading in the right direction, but the wind wasn't. If they were caught out in a sandstorm without adequate cover, there was little chance they'd survive it. He debated calling a halt to erect a shelter, juggling the odds of a major storm hitting them, their proximity to the coast, and the enraged army that wouldn't stop until every last man in their party was dead. Sunset was in an hour. He turned his back on the wind and nosed his horse onward. Despite its flagging pace, the animal was still faster than a man on foot. With a suddenness that left H.A. reeling, he reached the top of one more featureless dune and saw that there were no more. Below him spread the slag-gray waters of the South Atlantic, and for the first time he could smell its iodine tang. Rolling waves turned to white froth as they roared onto the broad beach. He lowered himself from his horse, his legs and back aching from the long ride. He didn't have the strength to whoop for joy, so he stood silently, a ghost of a smile on the corners of his lips as the sun retreated into the cold, dark waters.
"What is it, H.A.? Why'd you stop?"
Tim Waterman called when he was still 20 yards back and just coming up the final dune. Ryder looked down on the struggling figure, saw that Tim's brother wasn't far behind. A bit further back, young Smythe clung to his horse's back as the animal followed in its brethren's footsteps. John Varley wasn't yet in sight.
"We made it."
It was all he had to say. Tim spurred his horse for the final ascent, and when he saw the ocean, he let out a triumphant yell. He reached down from the saddle and squeezed H.A.'s shoulder.
"Never doubted you for a second, Mr. Ryder. Not for one damn second."
H.A. allowed himself a laugh.
"You should have. I sure as hell did."
The others joined them within 10 minutes. Varley looked the worst of the group, and H.A. suspected that rather than rationing his water, John had drunk most of it in the morning.
"So we've reached the ocean," Varley snarled over the crying wind. "What now? There's still a bunch of savages after us, and in case you didn't know, we can't drink that."
He thrust a shaky finger at the Atlantic. H.A. ignored his tone. He pulled his Baumgart half-hunter from his pocket and tilted it toward the dying sun to read its face.
"There's a tall hill a mile or so up the beach. We need to be on top of it in an hour."
"What happens in an hour?" Peter asked.
"We see if I'm the navigator you all hope I am."
The dune was the tallest in sight, towering 200 feet above the beach, and on its crest the wind was a brutal, constant weight that made the horses dance in circles. The air was filled with dust, and the longer they stayed on the hillock, the thicker the dust seemed to get. Ryder made the Waterman brothers and John Varley look up the beach to the north, while he and Peter kept watch to the south. The sun was well down as 7 o'clock came and went, according to H.A.'s pocket watch.
"They should have signaled by now."
A weight like lead settled in his stomach. It had been too much to ask. Crossing hundreds of miles of empty desert and thinking he could come within a few miles of a specific spot on the coast. They could be 100 or more miles from the rendezvous.
"There!"
Peter cried and pointed. H.A. squinted into the darkness. A tiny red ball of incandescence hung close to shore, far down the coast. It stayed within sight for no more than a second before vanishing once again. A man standing at sea level can see approximately 3 miles before the curvature of the earth blocks his view. By climbing the bluff, H.A. had extended their range to 18.5 miles in either direction. Adding the height the flare had climbed, he guessed their rendezvous was about 20 miles down the coastline. He had led them across the barren wastes to within sight of their target, a remarkable feat of navigation. The men had been awake for 48 torturous hours, but the thought that their hardships were almost at an end, with a king's ransom for a reward, buoyed them those last miles. The bluffs sheltered the broad beach from the intensifying sandstorm, but dust was clouding the waters along the surf line as sand settled onto the ocean. The once white crests were mud brown, and it seemed the seas were sluggish under the tons of sand blowing into it. At midnight, they could see the lights of a small ship anchored 100 yards from shore. The vessel was steel-hulled and coal-fired, a literal cargo ship about 200 feet long. Her superstructure was well aft, punctured by a single tall funnel, while the forward part of her hull was given over to 4 separate hatch covers for her holds, serviced by a pair of spindly derricks. Sand blasted at the ship, and H.A. couldn't tell if her boilers were still fired. The moon was mostly hidden by the storm, so he couldn't be sure if there was smoke coming from her funnel. When they were abreast of the steamer, H.A. plucked a small flare from his saddlebag, the only item besides the stones he'd refused to leave behind. He ignited the flare and waved it over his head, yelling at the top of his lungs to be heard over the gale. The men joined him, whooping and hollering, knowing in a few minutes they would be safe. A searchlight mounted on the ship's flying bridge snapped on, its beam cutting through the whirling sand and coming to rest on the group of men. They danced in its glow as the horses shied away. A moment later, a dory was lowered from the lifeboat mount, a pair of men working the oars with swift professional strokes that cut the distance in moments. A third figure sat in the back of the craft. The men rushed into the water to greet the boat as its keel sliced into the sand just inside the surf line.
"That you, H.A.?" a voice called out.
"You damn well better hope so, Charlie."
Charles Turnbaugh, first officer of the HMS Rove, leapt from the dory and stood knee-deep in the surf.
"So is this the biggest cock and bull story I've ever heard, or did you actually do it?"
H.A. held up one of his saddlebags. He shook it, but the wind was too fierce for anyone to hear the stones rattling around inside.
"Let's just say I've made your trip worth your while.
How long have you been waiting for us?"
"We got here 5 days ago and have been firing a flare every night at 7, just like you asked."
"Check your ship's chronometer. It's running a minute slow."
Rather than make introductions, H.A. said,
"Listen, Charlie, there's about 100 Herrera bucks after us, and the sooner we're off the beach and over the horizon, the happier I'll be."
Turnbaugh began directing the exhausted men into the dory.
"We can get you off the beach, but not over the horizon for a while."
Ryder put a hand on his dirty uniform jacket.
"What's the matter?"
"We grounded ourselves when the tide went out. The shoals and sandbars along the coast are always shifting. Come next high tide, we'll float free. Don't worry."
"Oh, one thing," Ryder said before stepping into the little boat. "Do you have a pistol?"
"What? Why?"
H.A. twitched his head over his shoulder to where the horses huddled together, growing more terrified as the storm strengthened.
"I think the captain has an old Webley," Turnbaugh said. "I'd be obliged if you fetched it for me."
"They're just horses," Varley said, huddled in the dory. "Who deserves something better than dying on this forsaken beach after what they did for us?"
"I'll do it," Charlie said.
H.A. helped push the little craft until she floated free and waded with the horses, talking to them soothingly and rubbing their heads and necks. Turnbaugh returned 15 minutes later and silently handed over the weapon. A minute after that, H.A. climbed slowly into the dory and sat unmoving as he was rowed out to the tramp freighter. He found his men in the wardroom devouring plates of food and drinking enough water to make each of them look a little green. H.A. took measured sips, allowing his body to adjust. Captain James Kirby stepped into the small room with Charlie and the ship's engineer just as H.A. took his first bite of stew left over from the officer's mess.
"H.A. Ryder, you've got more lives than a cat," the captain boomed.
He was a great bear of a man with thick, dark hair and a beard that reached midway down his chest.
"And if it had been anyone other than you making such a damn fool request, I would have told them to shove off."
The two men shook hands warmly.
"At the price you're charging, I knew you'd wait until hell froze over."
"Speaking of price..."
One of Kirby's bushy eyebrows climbed halfway up his forehead. Ryder placed his saddlebag on the floor and made a show of undoing its buckles, drawing out the moment until he could taste the crew's greed. He opened the flap, rummaged through the bag's contents until he found a stone he thought appropriate, and set it on the table. There was a collective gasp. The light in the wardroom was just a pair of lanterns hanging from hooks in the ceiling, but they caught the diamond's fire and cast it around so it looked like they were standing inside a rainbow.
"This ought to pay you for your trouble," H.A. deadpanned. "With a little change left over," Captain Kirby breathed, touching the stone for the first time.
A rough hand woke H.A. the following morning at 6. He tried to ignore it and turned away on the tiny bunk he was using while Charlie Turnbaugh was on duty.
"H.A., damn it! Get up!"
What is it?
We've got a problem.
The grimness in Turnbaugh's voice brought Ryder instantly awake. He swung off the bunk and reached for his clothes. Dust spilled from the cloth as he struggled into his pants and shirt.
What is it?
You have to see it to believe it.
Ryder was aware that the storm continued to blow stronger than ever. The wind screamed over the ship like an animal trying to claw its way in, while even stronger gusts made the entire vessel shudder. Turnbaugh led him up to the bridge. Dun light filtered through the windscreen, and it was almost impossible to see the Rove's bow only 150 feet away. H.A. saw the problem immediately. The storm had dumped so much sand on the freighter's deck that the weight of it pinned her to the bottom despite the rising tide. Furthermore, where once they had 100 yards of water between them and the beach, now less than 50 separated ship from shore. The Kalahari and the Atlantic were locked in their eternal struggle for territory, a fight between the erosive actions of waves versus the awesome volume of sand the desert could pour onto the waters. They had fought each other since the dawn of time, constantly reshaping the coastline as sand found weaknesses in the constant scouring of current and tide, and struggled to expand the desert a foot or a yard or a mile. And all this played out with little regard to the ship caught in the tumult.
"I need every available hand to start shoveling," Kirby said darkly. "If the storm doesn't abate, this ship is going to be landlocked by nightfall."
Turnbaugh and Ryder rousted their respective crews, and using coal shovels from the engine room, pans from the kitchen, and a hip bath from the captain's washroom, they ran into the raging storm. With scarves covering their mouths and the wind so strong that talking was impossible, they pushed mounds of loose sand off the deck and into the water. They raged against the tempest, cursing it because every shovelful they heaved over the side only seemed to come back into their faces. It was like trying to hold back the tide. They managed to get one hatch scraped clean, only to see the amount of sand piled onto the other three had doubled. 5 adventurers and a ship's complement of 20 was no match for the storm that had traveled across thousands of square miles of seared earth. Visibility was cut to almost zero, so the men worked blind, their eyes tightly closed to the stinging grit that assaulted the Rove from every point on the compass. After an hour of frantic work, H.A. went to look for Charlie.
"It's no use! We have to wait and hope the storm slows."
Even with his lips touching Turnbaugh's ear, Ryder had to repeat himself 3 times to be heard over the shrieking wind.
"You're right,"
Charlie screamed back, and together they went to recall their men. The crews staggered back into the superstructure, shedding cascades of sand with each step. H.A. and John Varley were the last ones through the hatch. H.A. out of duty to make sure everyone was all right. Varley because he had a rat's cunning to never give in when he was certain of a reward. It was still difficult to hear out of the wind inside the companionway.
"Dear Jesus, please let this end."
So awed by the force of nature arrayed against them, Peter was almost in tears.
"Do we have everyone?"
Charlie asked.
"I think so."
H.A. sagged against a bulkhead.
"Did you do a head count?"
Turnbaugh started counting off his people when there was a sharp rap on the hatchway.
"Good God! Someone's still out there!" someone called.
Varley was closest to the hatch and undogged the latches. The wind slammed the door against its stops as the gale whipped into the ship, scouring paint from the walls with the merest touch. It appeared no one was there. It had to have been a loose piece of equipment rattling outside. Varley lurched forward to close the door and had it almost shut when a bright silver blade emerged a handspan from his back. Gore dripped from the spear's tip, and when it was pulled from the raw wound, blood sprayed the stunned crew. John pirouetted as he collapsed to the deck, his mouth working soundlessly as his shirt turned crimson. A dark wraith, wearing little but feathers and a cloth around his waist, stepped over Varley with an assegai in his hands. Behind him, more shapes were primed for the charge, their war cries rivaling even that of the storm.
Herrero,
H.A. whispered with resignation, as the wave of warriors burst into the ship. The storm was a freak of nature, a once-in-a-hundred-years occurrence that raged for over a week, forever changing the coast of Southwest Africa. Once mighty dunes had been rendered flat, while others had grown to newer and even greater heights. Where once there were bays, now great peninsulas of sand thrust into the cold waters of the South Atlantic. The continent had grown 5 miles bigger in some places, 10 in others, as the Kalahari won one of its battles against its arch foe. The map would have to be redrawn for hundreds of miles up and down the coast. That is, if anyone cared to map the forlorn shore. Every sailor just knew to stay well off the treacherous seaboard. Of the Rove and all those aboard her, the official report listed her as lost at sea. And that wasn't far from the truth, though she lay not under hundreds of feet of water, but under an equal amount of pure white sand, nearly 8 miles inland from where the icy waves of the Benguela Current pounded against Africa's skeleton coast.